They can no longer control the price because of what's happening to the dollar, because they're always looking at it from that point of view. Is the dollar going down? Yep. They can no longer take silver down with the dollar. So they're sitting on their stock just like that.
Waiting.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing they
Okay.
can do. So
Right.
this is a fascinating situation. It's causing huge great problems in other markets, particularly the platinum market.
Right. And you've seen a huge
Big
spike up recently.
backwardations. Yeah. Big backwardations. And the thing that's fascinating, and there's a guy called David Jensen who's done some work on this, and I think someone else, a fellow called Davis, I think. What they've exposed is that China and America have been stockpiling platinum to the point where there's no liquidity left in London.
Alistair McLeod, good morning to you, or good afternoon to you, my friend. How are you?
Good morning, Annie. I'm fine, absolutely fine. Thanks.
Yeah, it's great to have you on again. As we just mentioned off camera, just the other day I had Steve Hanke on, and he was mentioning that there's some really it's really eerie, the similar parallels between 1929 to now, whether it's debt levels, whether it's a blow-off top in the stock market, or whether it's tariffs, really. I want your thoughts on that. And yeah, just give your thoughts.
Well, Steve is absolutely right. The similarities are eerie because you had the Roaring Twenties, which basically was credit being fueled into financial assets. We've had exactly the same thing. And that was followed by 1929 to 1932, when the equity bubble went pop. And that would also happen. The other thing that was, if you like, contemporaneous with the bursting of the credit bubble was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act. And what have we got today? Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act Mark II, and Trump's tariff tantrums, if you like. Now, we don't know quite how that's going to work out because he keeps on changing his mind. But one thing is absolutely certain. The consequences are going to be the same as or similar to the Smoot-Hawley tariff fiasco. And possibly even worse, because America is so much more dependent on foreign trade today compared with what it was dependent on back in 1929. What this means is that not only will we have the problems of 1929 Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, but on top of that, the dismantling of global supply chains, which didn't exist at the time, very, very slick logistics, which I mean, the logistics have been incredibly efficient. And of course, a lot of that efficiency is being undone as well. So this, I think, is far worse. And also, I'd like to also make the point that the credit bubble is far larger this time. I mean, in 1929, the expansion of credit under the Fed, this was their first, if you like, foray into trying to intervene in the economy under what was his name? Benjamin Strong, who was the Fed chairman at the time. I mean, he believed in putting credit into the economy. He also wanted to develop a discount market on lines that existed in London, which of course was outside the money supply statistics, so it's additional to it. What he was doing was just a fraction of what we have today. I mean, even in real terms, this is so much more destructive. The other thing which people just do not understand is that there is a limit on what the Fed can do in terms of controlling interest rates. The idea that the Fed can cut rates as President Trump wishes, by to 3% or something. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if they could do that? But they cannot do that for one very simple reason. And that is that there is increasing risk, credit risk, in not only dollar-denominated assets, but also in the dollar itself. And it is overrun by foreigners, foreigners who don't need to own so many dollars as they did in the past, purely for liquidity purposes. They are overinvested in the stock market. they have something like 15 and a half trillion invested in US stocks. This is according to the US tick figures. I mean, you know, when the market turns, what's going to happen? They're going to try and get the hell out of not only equities, but also the dollar. Now, quite a lot of the value of that 15 trillion will be lost, if you like, as the market falls. But you can see what's going to happen. You know, the flows are going to go the other way. And the similarities with 1929 are just so striking. The other thing that I think we must add into this is the outlook for US Treasury bond yields. When you get heightened risk, you need higher coupon, if you like, to protect you. In other words, the yield has got to rise to justify holding the extra risk. We saw this in this country, in the UK, back in 1976. We had, first of all, a sterling crisis in 1975. the Americans then, you know, supported sterling, but then sent in the IMF, basically, to put discipline on the government spending, which is what the IMF did. But, you know, at that time, we had interest rates well over 10%, I mean, up at 14 and 15%. And I remember gilts, which are our government bonds, if you like, the equivalent of US treasuries in the UK, being issued with coupons of over 15%. I mean, there was a 15, 15 and a quarter, and a 15 and a half in 1998. I remember it well. And they were issued at below par. So this is what happens when you get a currency problem, when you get... the currency's purchasing power falling, which is what is happening. I don't believe the CPI statistics. I mean, that doesn't tell you the real story. It's gold that is actually telling you the story. It's not gold going up so much, though there is a bit of that. But it's mainly the dollar and all the other currencies that sort of look up to it going down. They're losing purchasing power. It's as simple as that. And they're losing it at a far higher rate than what the CPI would tell you. That is the risk. Yeah. And so if you're a foreigner, I mean, this is what the central banks are doing. Central banks are looking at the situation, and these are the ultimate insiders. I know we think they're a bunch of fools, but they're not. They are the ultimate insiders. They look at the dollar, they look at what's happening, so they sell the dollar. But what do they buy? They buy real money with no counterparty risk. And there's only one thing. That's what's happening. And I think when you understand that, you can understand actually just how important this situation is. And I would say that technically on the chart, if you look at, sorry, I moved things slightly. If you look at the chart, technically, I think when the long bond yield goes above 5%, it's then on its way to 9% minimum. That's just
Whoa.
A technical analysis reading, and think what that does.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's exactly it. If you have the long bond at 9%, then you're going to have just a complete deflationary pressure, really, in the economy, because nobody's going to borrow. Nobody can borrow at 9%, correct?
Well, no business plan is going to stomach that sort of, level of borrowing costs. That is for sure. And not only that, but those who don't borrow and who, sort of cash positive will start thinking, well, what's my return on equity?
Right.
When the long bond's yielding 9%, you're not going to be satisfied with 5%. You know, you're going to be looking for something plus a risk premium on top of that. You're going to be looking at 15, 20% minimum. Get a return on your business. Otherwise, you just don't invest. No, you're right. It has a major impact the whole way through the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the relationship with equities, which we haven't really discussed yet, but it obviously makes sense that when you get a rising bond yield, that's bad for equity valuations because, every regulator tells you that a risk-free or a low-risk portfolio is one which is long bonds and, say, got twice as many bonds as they have equities, and a high risk one is twice as much equities as bonds. So, in other words, the valuation of bonds affects the valuation of equities. It's as simple as that. If you look at how the valuation of bonds has been performing relative to equities, equities have been rising and they have become more extremely overvalued relative to the long bond than they ever have been in history. This is a major, major credit bubble. Now, just imagine once the long bond rises through that 5% level, what happens to equities? It's toast. It really is. And people keep on telling me, well, the Fed can manipulate, they can manage interest rates. Well, yeah, if they try and manage interest rates, they'll just kill the dollar. They try and reduce interest rates. I mean, the dollar's toast. Probably toast anyway,
Yeah.
but it'll be more quick with if the Fed feels that it has to reduce interest rates because of the level of bankruptcies, both in the wider private sector and also within the banking system, or the risk of increasing bankruptcies and that sort of financial dislocation. If they do what Bernanke did back in 2008, nine, then the dollar is just gets killed. And I think this is really the end game for fiat currencies. It is the end game which central bankers, independent central bankers around the world actually see, which is why they're dumping fiat for real money, which is gold.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And it seems to me, and I want you to comment about that, that the Fed is really in a box, if you would. And even the administration, if you would, is somewhat in a box. And I don't know how much that they realize this, because it seems like they picked the bond market versus the dollar. I mean, they picked, well, they picked, it worked out so far so well. But I mean, if, I guess my point is, if they lower interest rates, that's going to, well, that's going to kill everything. That would kill, I mean, might have a short-term stimulation with in the economy, but it's going to kill both the bond market and the dollar. And so it's, what do they do? I mean, do you think they're going to lower, or I mean, are they going to have to lower?
Well, I think it becomes political. One thing which I think is extremely likely is that in September they will lower interest rates. They'll lower the Fed funds rate by a quarter of a percent. And I think that the betting is very much that way.
Yeah.
But as to, I mean, if I was on the FOMC and if I was sort of tasked with writing the comments, I think what I would do is I would report that, by a majority, we reckon that we were going to cut rates by a quarter of a percent. So that's what we've done. But then I would put in warnings about the level of inflation is still rising. And if it becomes apparent that that rise is no longer temporary, there's a wonderful phrase they used before. I'm trying to remember what it was. Do you remember? They kept
Transitory, transitory,
transitory.
transitory.
That's
Yeah.
it. That's it.
We've
That's
never
it.
had transitory before,
If
but
it
yeah.
is no longer, if it becomes apparent that this is not transitory, then we will not be able to cut rates from this level for some considerable time. That's the sort of thing I would say. So I think that there may be a little bit of dislocation on that statement. And the other interesting thing is that everybody in the markets finds that the summer is a very, Northern Hemisphere summer is a very quiet time. Nobody is actually thinking. They're out on holiday or they're with the kids, or in my case, with the grandkids. It's not the time to apply the old brain box to relative values and things like that. But when you get back and you've got committee meetings, investment strategy meetings and things like this, people then will start airing their concerns because they've had to sort of sit down and think. And it's generally at that stage that the market becomes really very vulnerable. And so, as to Steve Hanke's point about 1929, I wouldn't rule out the possibility that just as in 1929, Wall Street peaked in September, we could well do the same thing next month. But it's a
Right.
dangerous situation and not one you hang around in my view.
Yeah. Well, talk about the banking system, and I want to hear it from you. I think I know the direction you're going to take. But the banking system is all messed up as well. I don't want to say that in specifically the banks, not to name specific banks, but how are they making any money when you have especially commercial real estate and now you have domestic real estate here in the US that's severely cratering, severely slowing down. And then you have interest rates where they're at, and especially again, I couldn't imagine what it would do to real estate with the long bond yield, as you mentioned, a technical trajectory to 9 to 10%. Not to all our viewers and listeners, we're not saying that's where it's going to get there, but that's the trajectory if it breaks through 5. Talk to me about that. How are the banks going to survive or make any money, really?
Well, this is where things differ from 1929. In those days, there were lots and lots of small banks around the country. I mean,
Right.
when at the crisis, something like 10,000 banks were wiped out. These are all one and two branch type banks. We don't have that anymore. The banks are very big, and so they tend not to lend credit up and down the country. They will deal with credit in bulk. So things like credit cards and things like that. Okay, you've got a subsidiary company that runs all the credit card stuff. You've probably got, I don't know, figure like 250 billion of credit card debt or something. That's all in one bucket. You're not dealing with individual businesses, if you like, where somebody's actually got to think, do I want to lend money to this guy? Yeah. So there's nothing there. So where are they? Well, I mean, the answer is they're all in the financial enterprises. They're either investment banking or in which case they're doing sort of big company listings and corporation takeovers and all that sort of stuff, or they're dealing with the big boys. The big oil companies, the big pharmaceutical companies. The fashionable areas like AI, this sort of thing. So they're all in the big sort of relatively financial stuff, but particularly in speculation. They're involved in enhancing speculation in the market. And I was just struck. We've seen recently the level of margin credit reported by FINRA increase over the last 2 years by roughly $500 trillion. And if you look at M2, US M2, that has increased over the same period by, guess what, roughly $500 trillion. It's all gone into financing the stock market bubble. What more can one say? And I think that's going to be the problem. Once that goes into reverse, then you're going to get something that Irving Fisher first described, actually in the wake of 1929, collateral values falling, triggering sales of collateral, because they no longer cover the debt obligations.
They have to
So this
sell.
could happen quite quickly. Yeah. I think that's where the problem really is going to lie for the banks. So, the rescue, which the Fed inevitably will have to do, will be very much angled at supporting the, if you like, financial activities rather than economic activities.
Got it. So work out for me, and I want to get to gold. We touched on it, but I want to talk about gold here in a few minutes. But first, I want to talk about where you're at in the UK. I've heard just how, and I mean this with all due respect and love for the UK. I love the UK, by the way. I love the city of London. It's probably my favorite city in the world. What a town. My wife lived for 2 years in London. Absolutely loved it. It has everything you want as far as a cosmopolitan culture. I think the British people are some of they're gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen. They're so old school, all in the best way. That being said, it seems to me like that country is imploding really right now as we speak from a credit level. What are you experiencing now in the UK, and is that spreading? And it seems like it's spreading all through the continent of Europe.
Well, yeah. Basically, we've got too much debt, more debt than we can really afford. The interest element on the debt is roughly, I think it's something like 8 or 9% of government spending. I mean, it's a big, big figure. It really is. And of course, what I'm talking about, as far as the dollar is concerned, with bond yields rising there, I mean, bond yields rise in America, as I've described, they're also going to rise here. But worse than that, we've got a socialist government who basically is hurrying up the demise of this country. They are in a real hole. The first thing they did when they got in was to increase public spending, pay rises to, government employees, one sort or another, pay rises to unions, which they hadn't already got control over, but they've got an enormous influence over, like the railway unions. They're going to nationalize the railways too, believe it or not. I mean, all this is schoolboy socialism, if you like. I mean, these guys have been out of office for so long. I mean, they are impractical. And so that was on the one side. And then when they started trying to cover this with taxes, they hit all the things that they hate, like the middle classes and so on and so forth. So, what has happened is that, with the top 1% of taxpayers paying 30% of income tax, they're just leaving. They're saying, no, we're not going to put up with this. Goodbye. So, really what's happening is this is something that socialists do not believe in, but they're finding that they're falling down on the wrong side of the Laffer curve. They actually
Right.
don't believe the Laffer curve, but believe it or not, because it's not convenient to believe it, but they're
Right.
actually going down the wrong side of the Laffer curve. So we now have a situation where there's going to be an autumn statement. I think it's next month sometime, or October. I don't know. I don't know that we've even got a date for it. The numbers have gone so awry. I mean, we've lost in the private sector, we've lost over 100,000 jobs, and purely on the back of the first budget, which the rise in employment costs and all the rest of it. And guess what? We made up 100,000 jobs in the bureaucracies. Government employed the people, the same number of people as were being thrown out of the. And of course, in terms of GDP, where does that leave GDP? GDP looks wonderful, but it's not
Yeah.
productive. It's not productive. So we've got ourselves into this real hole. And now they're floating. And what happens is that the Treasury tries to float ideas through the press to see what the reaction is. And one of the ones they're floating is they're just going to take all our savings. Literally, literally. Just
You're gonna
grab our
seize
savings.
baby.
The latest suggestion is at the moment, if you give something to your children, right, as long as you live 7 years, you don't pay any inheritance tax on that gift. They're talking about doing away with that. So, in other words, I can't leave anything significant to my children. Think upon that. I mean, they're destroying
Yeah.
society apart from anything else. The whole thing is a mess. And I was it was lovely to hear your comments about how l wonderful London is and all the rest of it, but I guess you haven't been there for a little while. It's now a crime-ridden
It's
city.
5 years. Five
Yeah,
years.
I mean, the last I was in London, I think last month, I got a taxi back from my club to the to Waterloo. I got a taxi very easily, which was fine. I was chatting with the taxi driver and I said, well, it was nice to get a taxi so easily. And he said, well, the trouble is, Gov, that there's that nobody's coming to London because of all the crime. The tourists are not here. They're gone. It's no good. The hotels are suffering. The whole of the tourist industry, including restaurants and cabbies and all the rest of it, they're not getting the business. And it's because of the deterioration of law and order in London. Because when you read about London, you read about how people snatch mobile phones out of your hands, or they
Yeah.
steal your Rolex watches off your wrist on pain of being stabbed. That is the story. So yeah, London isn't quite as nice as you may remember. I just hang on to the memories and don't come back for a little while.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you went there too. And again, we've had great memories, nothing but great memories there. I took my son to see a Chelsea football game. I want to say this was in 2019, right before COVID. That was the last time we were over there. And it's saddens me what's happening to one of what was once and maybe still is one of the premier cities in the world. And I put that up there with New York and Tokyo and maybe Paris. It just was a fantastic city, and it's really heartbreaking to see the deterioration. Where is the money going if it's leaving the UK? Where are they going?
Well, they're going to Dubai is very popular. I mean, there's no tax in Dubai. The cost of living is obviously somewhat higher. Quite a few are going to Milan. The Italians have done a deal. You know, we'll you can pay 100,000 euros a year, and then you're absolutely free of tax after that. No tax on, you know. So you can be you can be a multimillionaire, billionaire, whatever. Your tax is only 100,000 euros, which is peanuts.
Right.
Switzerland, obviously. I think some are going to Portugal, where again, there's a similar sort of deal. I guess that, I mean, that's the sort of bulk of it. I mean, the great thing is the chief of, the head of Goldman Sachs in Europe has relocated from London to Milan. You know, that tells you
Wow.
everything.
Right.
And
Right.
I think there are going to be more doing that. I mean, there's the old story was, you know, the problem with the socialists is that they spend everybody else's money until they run out. And we're seeing that process.
Yeah.
It's actually quite it's quite instructive as well, because you know, what do you do if you like, if you've got some personal wealth? Well, I mean, you know, you probably got a portfolio of stuff. They're going to raise capital gains taxes. That's another one. I think that's pretty sure. So when you know, what do? You sort of sell shares where you got a nice profit? You think, no, I'm not going to give government tax. So the result is that going back to the 29-32 situation, the doppelganger for that, then you know, you're going to go to bed with collapsing equity values. It's as simple as that. So you really want to get out of things which you know, or just not have things which are taxable. There are a few things around, you know, like coins of the realm. You know, gold sovereigns are free of capital gains tax because it is legal tender. Not that anyone would swap it for a pound, because you can buy and sell them at over £600 each now. That's how much has gone down. So the whole thing, I'm afraid, Andy, is one hell of a big mess, and it's getting worse very rapidly. I have to say that I expected it, and even though you know, you open the newspaper in the morning and you see something else, you think, oh my God, and all the rest of it. But you know, it's going to happen anyway. It's happening anyway. We're getting
Yeah.
wiped out. So you need to understand what you've got to do in order to not get wiped out by it.
Yeah. Let's go back to currency wars and gold here. It seems like currencies are all relative to something, if you would, and they're all, if correct me if I'm wrong, they're all in the same boat. And that's really why gold has been on a tear. Talk to me about that and what are your expectations here through and again, it's really hard to project shorter term, but what are your expectations here, shorter and midterm here, for the for gold and how this is going to get worked out?
Well, as I, you know, as I keep on saying, the difference between gold and everything else in terms of circulating medium is that gold is legal money. In Roman law, it is known as corporeal money. In other words, it actually physically exists, and it is final settlement where there is no counterparty risk. Credit is everything else, absolutely everything else. And it's the value of credit which, under a gold standard, gets secured to the value of gold. But if you don't have that sheet anchor, then the value of credit can drift around, up, down, whatever. But of course, given that the objective of not having a gold standard is so that you can expand credit, certainly at the central bank level, not productively, but to finance government spending, government wars, welfare, whatever, non-productive, if you like. then inevitably the value of credit gets devalued relative to gold. And it's not gold going up, it's credit going down. That is the key thing to understand. As we say, and I, the thing about the dollar is that we've really been on a dollar standard, a fiat dollar standard, as opposed to a gold standard, but loosely, so that every currency sort of, it doesn't tie itself to the dollar, but it looks at the dollar, if you like, and sort of thinks about the relative valuation between the dollar and itself. So you've got, that's basically the relationship. It means that individual currencies can move quite significantly, but the dynamics behind it are the same as they always were. And that is interest rate differentials. Under a gold standard, it's very easy to manage your gold reserves. Basically, you increase interest rates so that gold flows from a lower interest rate environment into your environment. When it comes to fiat currencies, you've got the same sort of situation where you've got rates being held up relative to rates elsewhere, then that currency is going to be relatively strong. And I think this is the thing which has so far meant that the dollar hasn't fallen against other currencies as much as it might have done. I mean, you look at the chart, the dollar is heading lower. There will come a point, I think, where that turns round and other currencies begin to lose against the dollar. But at the moment, all attention is focused on the dollar. I mean, you know, you get, was it 4.35, something like that, on 3 month T-bills. That's, you know, putting risks and things aside, that is quite attractive relative to what you get in yen and what you get in euros. You get a bit more in sterling, but, you know, again, sterling is overrun by foreigners big time for that reason. I mean, you know, the stuff ticks up, if you like, in your P&L in a very attractive way. Only at 4.6% in the case of the UK's 10-year gilt. Currently, it's about 4.3% in the US Treasury 10-year note. So that is, I think, the thing that has been holding the relationships at the moment. The moment, however, we get a cut in the Fed funds rate, which we will get in September, I mean, we know that almost for certain, then the dollar's going lower. Of that, I have absolutely no doubt, because it's the front end of the yield curve that's going to determine the currency relationships. But there will come a point where, and I think it'll be the rising bond yields on the long end, there will come a point where suddenly the risks in other currencies will become a lot more obvious. And then you're looking at pricing in higher risks there. So at that stage, I would expect sterling to fall very, very heavily. I mean, I really think it's wildly overvalued at the current level. It's only held up where it is by higher interest rates than you, or higher short-term rates than you have in euros or indeed in yen. But that is beginning to change, I think. So, yeah, that's what determines the relationships. So, short-term dollar's going down, I think. At some stage, that will turn around. But in gold, of course, it's a completely different matter, because what you're looking at is the complete fiat currency system valued in real money, valued in real money. And I cannot see the circumstances where the attractiveness, if you like, of fiat currencies is going to recover and undermine the value of gold. I mean, other than normal fluctuations. Yeah, I mean, it's really as simple as that, Andy. And I think that we probably don't have very long, really. I mean, one of the things that's also you've got to feed into this is that the global economy has slowed down quite considerably, going back to the point about tariffs and all the rest of it. Also, if you take out the government spending deficit out of the GDP numbers, already, private sectors are contracting. And I think when people understand that, they will then begin to actually put a proper risk weighting on these fiat currencies. And that's going to drive them even lower relative to gold.
And we're already seeing that. I say this anecdotally, but I live in Atlanta, Georgia, the suburbs, if you would, of Atlanta, Georgia. And I'm already seeing that just with small businesses here. And most of my friends are in the private sector, just the hardness of really just bringing an income with their business, if you would. It's slowed down immensely here. And again, that's anecdotal, but I think that really is across the board. That's just a microcosm of everything else going here on the US. So.
Well, we have the same thing here. I mean, that it's I think it's the same everywhere. There is a lack of credit availability for businesses. Small and medium-sized businesses are starving for lack of credit, and inevitably that becomes lack of business because production and consumption are interrelated.
Right.
Quite simple.
Yeah. So central banks have been the biggest buyers of gold, really, well, for the past several years. And it seems like they've increased their allocation to gold. Do you expect that trend to continue? I know your answer, but I'd love for you to talk about that, as well as do you see them also diversifying into things like silver and maybe other commodities?
It's an interesting question. I mean, basically, I do see them continuing to get out of credit, which means that they buy gold. I don't think any central banks think in terms of silver as being a monetary metal. I mean, in the past, it has been a monetary metal, particularly after we came off silver standards. It's been legal exchange basically for small amounts. So I think is the extent of the relationship. I'm not saying that silver shouldn't be regarded as a monetary metal. I think it should be to a great extent. So central banks, I think, will continue to buy gold. But you raise an interesting point because under the laws which appoints the People's Bank of China as the sole manager of the state's gold reserves, that legislation also said exactly the same thing about silver, the state's silver. So, in other words, it is seen by the Chinese as part of a, if you like, a wider foreign exchange remit for the People's Bank of China, which actually makes sense because if you think back, China was on silver standard, I think, until relatively late, something like 1968, I think. So that's an interesting point as to whether the People's Bank has actually been manipulating the price of silver in the past and whether its policy has changed. I think its policy has changed. I think they've gone from importing silver doré at the lowest possible price, accumulating silver in hidden reserves, just as they've done with gold. I think they've now gone into a policy of, well, the trouble is that we're now got to push so much silver out to control the market that actually we'd rather hoard it than do that, and we'll just ride the
Whoa.
higher price. I mean,
So
there is a
if we could pull
backstory
that string some, yeah, I want to hear it. Go ahead.
to this. There is a backstory to this. Many years ago, I think it was over a decade ago. I had a speaking gig in New York, and it was one of these conferences where I think there was something like 20 odd silver miners and exploration companies exhibiting at this conference. And at the time, there was a lot of controversy. The thought was that JP Morgan were manipulating the market, and Blythe Masters was played by everybody, this wicked witch from England and all the rest of it. The interesting thing is that just before this, she had appeared on, I think it was, I can't, one of the big US TV stations, and made it absolutely clear that JP Morgan did not take positions for themselves in the silver market. What they would do is they would deal on behalf of their clients. So that sort of said, okay, right. Now, Blythe Masters is not an idiot. She's not going to stand up and lie. People in that position do not tell lies, I can tell you. They may be economical with the truth, but they do not tell lies. So I wasn't into that conspiracy theory. Anyway, so I thought, right, I better go and see do a bit of homework on this. So I asked all these miners and exploration companies, all in turn, and they came up with exactly the same answer to the same question. The question I asked them is, how do you turn your silver into cash? Because you've obviously got to pay mining costs, energy and miners' salaries and all the rest of it. And they all said the same thing. They said, a chap from Glencore comes along and he assesses the value of the dory. It's then shipped off, and we are paid immediately by a bank, who I assume in this case was JP Morgan, because they would be working with, we're talking about big corporates working together, yeah? I then asked, well, where do you think, where do they, where do they get shipped off to? So, well, we don't know. It's not our business. We're just paid, as soon as the assessment is made and it leaves the site. But we assume it would be China. Now, that did make sense because at the time, refineries in Canada, for example, were being closed and so on. And basically, refining silver is, rather like refining gold, is a pretty dirty business. It's not something that you want to upset the environmentalists with and all the rest of it. Then you probably, as a government, produce all sorts of regulations to make it difficult anyway. So, yeah, China was basically importing gold and silver dory in huge quantities, refining it, and guess what? Never leaves. But what the Chinese were doing was they were hedging this stuff to suppress the price through COMEX. And guess who was doing the hedging? Our friends JP
JP.
Morgan. They were not dealing off their own book. They were hedging on behalf of the Chinese government. That's the key thing. So
Interesting.
this is how they control the price. And they've been doing this for years, absolutely years. So, just occasionally it sort of runs away, ran away, sort of some sort of speculative bubble takes it up to $50 or something, but they, you kill it quite quickly after that. That's fine. And, I mean, look, I've been a broker and I know how these things work. The way I would work it with the Chinese, and this would suit the Chinese, is we have a quarterly meeting to discuss what we're actually going to do, how much is going to flow through, what our price targets are, and all the rest of it. And okay, JP Morgan, go to it. So
Right.
that's what happened.
Right.
Anyway, I noticed that in 2023, China exported quite a lot of silver. I can't remember the figure, something like 123 million ounces, something like that. I mean, it doesn't sound huge. But amazingly, it exported it to places like Singapore, Hong Kong, London. And these are not really known as places where, photovoltaic cell production, which is the main demand now, also military demand, is really, as part of those sort of centers. I mean, they're financial centers. So this was obviously being pushed into the market to try and control the price. There were exports the following year in 2024, last year. I think same sort of thing, but not going into financial centers. There's obviously a shortage globally anyway of silver. We know that from the Silver Institute's numbers. And I think what's happened is that the Chinese have now taken the view that they've got silver on board. They can no longer control the price because of what's happening to the dollar, because they're always looking at it from that point of view. Is the dollar going down? Yep. They can no longer take silver down with the dollar. So they're sitting on their stock just like that.
Waiting.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing they
Okay.
can do. So
Right.
this is a fascinating situation. It's causing huge great problems in other markets, particularly the platinum market.
Right. And you've seen a huge
Big
spike up recently.
backwardations. Yeah. Big backwardations. And the thing that's fascinating, there's a guy called David Jensen who's done some work on this, and I think someone else, a fellow called Davis, I think. What they've exposed is that China and America have been stockpiling platinum to the point where there's no liquidity left in London, in the London only
Wow.
counterpart. So, you've now got it, if you like, a sort of, it's not quite like the nickel explosion on the
I
LME.
wanted to bring that up. Yeah, go ahead. Go
And
ahead.
that was a slightly different thing. I mean, the nickel problem on the LME was one of incompatibility of delivery.
Right.
The big short was someone in the nickel business in China, but they didn't have nickel in deliverable form, so they couldn't settle the contract. So
Yeah. Yep,
it's
I
a
remember.
slightly minor technical error there, but upsetting
Right.
everybody. But you can see this is, but I mean, the thing that's interesting, Andy, is in general terms, we know that the purchasing power of gold holds relatively true through long periods of time. So when you get a major deviation from price, in the gold price for something, let's say a basket of metals, base metals, then you know that the base metals being mispriced. Now that's exactly the situation we have now. Courtesy of the IMF, they produce a series of different commodity baskets, one of which is base metals, and it includes things like copper, antimony, nickel, lead, all the normal stuff. And I could work that back to the year 1900, taking the 1900 value of this basket in gold as being our starting point. There has been some fluctuation over the years, but broadly speaking, it has held around about that sort of level. I mean, some obviously have gone up and some have gone down within the basket. I mean, that's why you have a some sort of basket, as it were. The value of that basket today, measured in gold, is only 23% of what it was in 1900.
Wow.
In other words, either gold is too high or the basket is too low.
Yeah.
So,
There's an
I
argument
mean,
there.
the point is, we can see from the way monetary policy is and all the rest of it, that there is some justification that gold is ahead of the game compared with base metals. Fine, we can understand that. But if base metals are to normalize in gold, then we're going to see them go up by a multiple of three or four times in gold. And if gold is going to continue to rise in collapsing fiat currency, then the rise in these base metal values, measured in dollars, is going to be even greater. And it could happen quite quickly. So what we have got is we have got a developing slump in economic activity. But at the same time, the commodities that you would think would suffer in that slump have either already discounted it completely or are so completely mispriced that they're going to rise even in the middle of a slump.
Yeah.
So what's that going to
So,
do to everything? I mean,
yeah, right.
this is, I mean, we're coming to the end of the fiat currency system, which is now 54 years old, and there's so many things that are going to go wrong. It's actually, I mean, it's, if you were on another planet observing what was going on, you'd find the whole thing somewhere between hilarious and very interesting.
I find it both. So you just that was great, by the way. And I would I love how you frame it too. I absolutely agree with you. And to all my viewers and listeners, I think that's the way to frame it, that the fiat system is coming to an end, as opposed to thinking of it as a single fiat coming to an end. I think the system, the fiat system, is coming to an end. This is anecdotal, but you brought up, like, you went to a conference years ago and how these companies were selling it directly, and I'm paraphrasing, directly more or less is ending up in China. I have been to many conferences in the past 2 years. I've probably talking to between anywhere from 200 to 400 mining companies in the past 2 years. And I posed the same question to a couple of these people. One of my questions is, okay, you're coming into production. Do you have a mill? Where are you si shipping the metal, whether that's gold or silver, to be processed? I probably posed that question to maybe 20 plus of these companies. And between 5 and 10 of them have told me, well, we don't need a mill. We're shipping it to China. That's what they
Interesting.
told me in the last 12 to 18 months or 24 months. That's exactly what they told me. Very interesting indeed. And you think you've already answered this question, but I just want to work it out a little bit more. I remember the nickel situation on the LME very, very clearly. And it seems like that could, again, potentially very well happen again, specifically not only in base metals, but with silver, because there's no supply, if you would. Yeah, work that out a little bit more for me. And it seems like that's your thoughts.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's sort of kind of confusing because you look at the silver stocks on COMEX and they're up at a record. It's all been sucked elsewhere. Because the other side of the story, and it's more true in gold than it is in silver, is that you've got stands for delivery, and we don't know what the hell's going on there. Who's taking delivery? This stands for delivery isn't price sensitive or anything. I mean, it wasn't meant to happen, actually. I mean, the whole idea of a futures market is you use it as a hedging tool, not as something to take delivery. But I think so far this year, something like 860 tons of gold has been delivered, and about 8,300 tons of silver. These are very significant flows, and presumably, the stock of silver sitting in COMEX is all waiting to be delivered, if you like. Some of it already committed, because obviously standing for delivery doesn't actually mean that you take delivery. But for users of silver, I mean, what do you do? If you're an industrial user, do you sort of, just take it and store it in your warehouse or something? No, you don't. You leave it in, in the COMEX warehouses, which where at least is secure and all the rest of it and insured. You don't want to take delivery until you actually want to use it. So I think a lot of that is just accumulating on that basis. Gold is more interesting because I guess, and this is a guess, that it's some of the central banks, some of the sovereign wealth funds, and so on and so forth, trying to cover their position. I wonder also, and this is just a thought out of the blue, as to whether some central banks who have leased gold in the past and found that it's just disappeared into the market are trying to cover their position because they don't want to be found out. I mean, if we're coming to the end of the fiat currency system, if you're worried about the future of the dollar, then obviously you've got to start worrying about how much gold you've actually got. Have you got it secured? And what happened to all that stuff you leased, which never really came back? You've probably still got an IOU floating around somewhere. So, what does this do to the liquidity in the gold market? I think that the liquidity in the gold market is gone because the whole of the forward LBMA forward dealing system, and also to an extent COMEX, really does depend on the availability of physical to oil the wheels of the paper market. And that has always come from leasing, and it's sort of, it's the Bank of International Settlements dealing and, taking gold from, say, the Bank of Portugal, because it's got a collateral, then using it in the market, hypothecating it, rehypothecating it, and so on and so forth. Same with the Bank of England. Upon which point, wasn't it fascinating that back in March, the Bank of England reported that there was a 6-week queue to withdraw gold from its vaults. He couldn't handle the volume. Until that time, basically, what a leasing central bank had been told was, oh, don't worry, that's what will happen is that we'll just do a book entry so that possession of the gold over a period of the lease will move to X. Okay, so that's now, so in other words, it was a book entry transfer system within the vaulting arrangements. Okay, I'm happy with that. That's absolutely fine. But now, the people that we've leased this to are taking it out, and it's gone. Are we going to get it back? And so you can see how this informs central banks who have been storing gold, not just in London, but also in Paris, and also in the Bank of the Federal Bank of New York. Where's our gold? We better get this under control. We don't want to do any more leasing. It's too uncertain. And furthermore, we need to repatriate it. I understand that Croatia, which is a pretty small player in this, has got sufficiently worried that it's getting all its gold back. I don't know where the hell it's storing it, probably under the central bank governor's bed. But you know, this is a real problem. And of course, it does mean that the liquidity which drives the paper market is gone. Consequences yet to unfold.
Yeah, I would agree with everything you said. That's the thing, is the liquidity. Yeah, it's gone and it goes. And I think that's really what the gold market is showing us here today, but just really for the last, really, I would say 2 years, but even before then, as banks are buying it. Alastair, I've taken way too much of your time. If people want to do business with you, if they want to find out more about you, if they want to contact you, where do they go and how do they do that?
Well, I spend most of my waking moments now thinking about my Substack and Substack subscribers. So I have a Substack, which is alastairmcleod.substack.com. My mission really is to try and educate people so that they don't fall completely as victims of our deteriorating financial system, financial and currency system. And I think this is desperately important. It's no longer a question of trying to accumulate wealth. It's a question of trying to protect what you've got. And the only way you can do that is get out of credit as much as you possibly can. We all need some credit. We all do. I mean, in the form of bank deposits or whatever. But really, it's getting just too dangerous, I think, to have the view that I'm in the business of accumulating credit. I mean, if you know what you're doing, you can buy some mines, should do you all right. But again, you see, if the system falls apart, the integrity of those investments may well be called into question by a collapsing collateral system. you know, your mine might be all right, but you know, all you have from you know, when you own a share certificate, is you have a promise by the management to accumulate dividends, or in lieu of dividends, money, if you like, for you as a shareholder in the company's books. And but it's worse than that now, because if you don't have a certificate, in other words, you just merely have a computer entry, the relationship between the company and its creditor as a shareholder is, of course, Euroclear or one of those systems. So they've got the whole thing. They own it and they can do what they want with it. They've got an obligation to you in turn. But you know, you're going down the list of priorities here. And when you get a collapsing credit system, then you know, better be out of the credit system, full stop.
Alastair, I want to thank you so much. I'll link to your Substack in the YouTube channel, as well as the Apple and Spotify podcast. I want to thank you so much. You're always very gracious to me with your time, and I just love talking to you and your insights. So I want to thank you so much.
Very much my pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Andy.
Take care.